Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 239, but who's counting? It's Monday, December 11th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get started with a story about the single largest preventable cause of death, smoking. This from Medical Express. Tobacco-related annual healthcare costs of U.S. minorities who smoke are double that of white peers. The annual tobacco-related healthcare spend of U.S. minorities who smoke is double that of white adults who smoke, finds an analysis of national health and medical spending survey data published online in the journal Tobacco Control. And the excess risk of three or more long-term health conditions associated with smoking are more than 40% higher among minority adults, despite their lower smoking rates and more numerous quit attempts than their white peers, the analysis indicates. The findings prompt the researchers to conclude that minority adults who smoke stand to benefit substantially more from tobacco control policies than do white adults who smoke. Each year, 480,000 people die in the U.S. before their time from diseases linked to smoking, making tobacco use the leading cause of preventable illness and death in the U.S. Minority adults were significantly more likely to have three or more of the top 10 conditions associated with smoking in the U.S. high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, joint pain, cancer, heart attack, arthritis, asthma, heart disease, and stroke. They were 34% more likely to do so compared with 24% for white adults who smoked. Between 2008 and 2016, smoking comprised 7.5% of the nation's total healthcare spending for white adults and nearly 11% for minority adults. But by 2017 to 2019, this had fallen to 2.5% for white adults, but only 9% for minority adults. So that's a drop from 7.5% of total spending for whites down to 2.5% over those two time periods, and a drop from 11% to 9% for minority adults. This indicates that they have not benefited much from the medical cost savings associated with a large reduction in smoking rates over the decades, says the researchers. Based on these data, the researchers estimate that any new tobacco control regulations would save $134 million a year for every 100,000 minority adults who didn't start smoking, 135% more than the $57 million for the same number of white adults. So you get way more money, more bang for the buck, if you do prevention among minority youth to prevent them from start smoking in the first place. 135% more than if you're dealing with white adolescents. There, that's the kind of thing in public health, the kind of data we need to be able to target efforts that have the most positive effect. Where to target it, whatever limited resources we have. But of course, getting anybody to stop smoking is likely a very cost-effective intervention. Okay, well, next up, we got a story on a condition that's often misunderstood, chronic fatigue syndrome. This from Medical Express. Chronic fatigue syndrome is not rare, says a new CDC survey. It affects 3.3 million U.S. adults. Health officials last Friday released the first nationally representative estimate of how many U.S. adults have chronic fatigue syndrome, 3.3 million. The CDC's number is larger than previous studies have suggested, and it is likely boosted by some of the patients with long COVID. The condition clearly is not a rare illness, said the CDC's Dr. Elizabeth Unger, one of the report's co-authors. Chronic fatigue is characterized by at least 6 months of severe exhaustion, not helped by bed rest. Patients also report pain, brain fog, and other symptoms that can get worse after exercise, work, or other activity. There's no cure and no blood test or scan to enable a quick diagnosis. Doctors have not been able to pin down a cause, although research suggests that it is a body's prolonged overreaction to an infection or other jolt to the immune system. Among the other findings, the syndrome was more common in women than men, and in white people compared to some other racial and ethnic groups. Those findings are consistent with earlier, smaller studies. However, the findings also contradicted long-held perceptions that chronic fatigue syndrome is a rich white woman's disease. There was less of a gap between women and men than some previous studies suggest, and there was hardly any difference between white and black people. The study also found that a higher percentage of poor people said they had it than affluent people. Those misperceptions may stem from the fact that patients who are diagnosed and treated traditionally tend to have a little more access to health care and maybe are a little more believed when they say they're fatigued and continue to be fatigued and can't go to work, said Dr. Braden Yellman, a specialist at the Bateman Horne Center in Salt Lake City. Experts believe only a fraction of the people with chronic fatigue syndrome are diagnosed, said Dr. Daniel Claw, director of the University of Michigan's Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center. It's never in the U.S. become a clinically popular diagnosis to give because there's no drugs approved for it. There's no treatment guidelines for it, Claw said. The tally likely includes some patients with long COVID who were suffering from prolonged exhaustion, CDC officials have said. Long COVID is broadly defined as chronic health problems weeks, months, and years after an acute COVID-19 infection. Symptoms vary, but a subset of patients have the same problems seen in people with chronic fatigue syndrome. We think it's the same illness, Yellman said, but long COVID is more widely accepted by doctors and is being diagnosed much more quickly, he said. So this doesn't mean that all long COVID is chronic fatigue syndrome, but a lot of people with long COVID have chronic fatigue syndrome. Okay, well, last week I reported on a new proposed policy to get lead pipes completely replaced over the next 10 years, which is a big advance. But this story talks about some of the background, some of the data analysis that was used to look at the kind of costs and benefits of that. And a good example, good case study of how good public health data analysis can lead to good public health policy. This from Stat News. Getting the lead out of the water supply. How one health expert crunched the numbers and prodded the EPA. It's known that lead in the water supply has severe health effects, including brain damage in children and heart and liver issues in adults. Now the Environmental Protection Agency has released an ambitious and expensive proposal to replace 100% of the lead pipes in water system service lines across the country over the next 10 years. Ronnie Levin, who's been working on lead contamination issues for 40 years as a former EPA scientist and an environmental health instructor at the Harvard School of Public Health, deems it, quote, a good move in the right direction that we haven't seen in a long time. It took some improvements to get there, though. The proposal to strengthen its lead and copper rule, issued on November 30th, comes after an earlier and weaker version was presented in October of 2022. Levin and her colleague Joel Schwartz, also at the Harvard School of Public Health, reviewed the cost-benefit analysis of that earlier proposal, finding that the benefits attributed by the EPA to lead pipe replacement were significantly underestimated. They published their own cost-benefit analysis, which they believe influenced the EPA to revise its proposal. The new proposed rule will cost an estimated $20 to $30 billion over the next decade. But rather than address, as the earlier proposal had, a single health benefit to lead pipe removal, that is, the protection of children's IQ and future earnings, the latest proposal incorporates 8 of the nearly 20 health consequences of lead exposure that the EPA has itself enumerated. Levin and Schwartz published their cost-benefit analysis, incorporating expanded benefits first online in May and then on July 15th, peer-reviewed in the journal Environmental Research. Compared to the original EPA proposal, their analysis pointed to a dramatically higher benefit of pipe removal. While the original rule suggested the health benefits would amount to $645 million a year, the new analysis said the health benefit would be $9 billion a year for a cost of $335 million. The rule, the researchers found, would also bring $2 billion in infrastructure benefit, making the benefit-to-cost ratio 35-1 compared to the original 2-1 benefit. The government's new proposal takes these findings into account, though it still doesn't include all the health benefits evaluated by Levin and Schwartz. It included enough to justify a 100% lead pipe removal in a decade. Go public health, and just remember, one of the core functions of public health is assessment. A problem well defined is half solved. Okay, well, next up I want to do a story that is perhaps the perfect example of the wonders of technological advancement, but then juxtapositioning that with the chronic problems of access to those so-called technological wonders. This from Stat News. In historic decision, FDA approves a CRISPR-based medicine for treatment of sickle cell disease. The FDA last Friday approved the world's first medicine based on CRISPR gene editing technology, a groundbreaking treatment for sickle cell disease that delivers a potential cure for people born with a chronic and life-shortening blood disorder. But for all of its virtues, whether or not this gene treatment becomes a widely used treatment for people living with sickle cell, undoing decades of scientific neglect and medical racism, remains an open question. The price of this treatment just approved was put at $2.2 million, and this is compared to the other treatment that's been available, that's $3.1 million. That's millions of dollars. The therapies are also not easy to receive. Patients must spend weeks, even months, in the hospital before and after the therapy is administered. And some of the preparatory steps can cause serious side effects, including severe infections, nausea, painful mouth sores, and infertility. I'm skeptical that this will open the floodgates, as some people are predicting, said Akshay Sharma, a physician who treats children with sickle cell at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This treatment has the potential to be a transformative therapy, Sharma added, but I would expect physicians and patients to be nervous and hesitant until its long-term efficacy and safety are better defined. Sickle cell disease is caused by a mutation in a gene responsible for the production of oxygen-carrying hemoglobin, a protein in red blood cells. The mutation causes red blood cells to become misshapen. Under a microscope, they look like crescents or sickles, which gives the disease its name. When sickled red cells clump together, they clog blood vessels, robbing tissues of oxygen and causing bouts or crises of extreme pain, hospitalizations, organ damage, stroke, and early death. Physicians who treat people with sickle cell today prescribe a number of medicines that can reduce the frequency of pain crises, increase hemoglobin levels, or ameliorate symptoms, but none targets the underlying genetic cause of the disease. Stem cell transplants can be curative, but the procedure requires patients to have a donor with matched immune cells, which occurs very infrequently. Okay, well, next up, I have a story that puts this story in the United States into a global perspective and sickle cell as a public health problem globally. This from the New York Times. New sickle cell therapies will be out of reach where they are needed most. One therapy will launch in the United States. Another has been prioritizing winning approval in six wealthy countries: the U.S., Italy, Britain, France, Germany, and Saudi Arabia, that, by one estimate, are home to 2% of the global sickle cell population. Three-quarters of the world's sickle cell patients are in sub-Saharan Africa. Several million of them are believed to be sick enough that they would be eligible for the new therapies, compared with some 20,000 in the United States. New medicines often debut in wealthy countries years before they arrive in poorer parts of the world. The disparities have been exacerbated in recent years as a wave of cutting-edge therapies with breathtaking price tags had transformed the lives of patients in wealthy countries. The company producing this newest therapy in particular has faced criticism for keeping its pioneering cystic fibrosis drugs out of reach of thousands of patients in lower-income countries. Manufacturers charge high prices even when it's clear that lower-income countries can't afford to pay these costs, to protect their ability to demand higher prices in places like the United States and Europe. Questions about access extend to the United States, where many people with the disease are poor and live in states that have not expanded their Medicaid programs. About half of those that have sickle cell are on Medicaid. And of course, some of those live in places with expanded Medicaid, which may eventually get treatment of this, but today, not good access. Few African countries have even routine screening of newborns for sickle cell, which is standard in wealthy countries. Undiagnosed, those children miss out on a crucial treatment with penicillin that can stave off the pneumonia that often kills sickle cell patients as babies. In Nigeria, there are estimates that up to half of children with sickle cell die before their fifth birthday. Beyond that, many do not have access to a medication called hydroxyurea that keeps red blood cells round and reduces episodes of severe pain. That medication costs about $7 per patient per month in Nigeria, which still keeps it beyond the range of many families. Dr. Nonodo said many of her patients struggle to afford even basic pain medications such as analgesics or folic acid. And of course, folic acid is a vitamin that actually is essential for producing red blood cells and avoiding anemia, aggravated by, of course, sickle cell conditions. Now, of course, the millions of dollars treatment costs is a whole question in and of itself. But given that a therapy is available, it should be equitably distributed. Just another reason to look for universal health care, both within the United States and across the globe.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north, at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, let's turn to a very common global health issue, and that's among women who have childbirth. And this causes a lot of lasting issues. This from Medical Express. More than one in three women have lasting health problems after giving birth. Every year, at least 40 million women are likely to experience a long-term health problem caused by childbirth, according to a new study published in The Lancet Global Health. Part of a special series on maternal health, the study shows a high burden of postnatal conditions that persist in the months or even years after giving birth. These include pain during sexual intercourse, affecting more than a third of postpartum women, low back pain at about a third, anal incontinence in 19%, urinary incontinence in 8 to 31%, anxiety in 9 to 24%, depression between 11 and 17%, perineal pain in 11%, fear of childbirth 6 to 15%, and secondary infertility 11%. The authors of the paper call for greater recognition within the healthcare system of these common problems, many of which occur beyond the point where women typically have access to postnatal services. Effective care throughout pregnancy and childbirth is also a critical preventive factor to detect risks and avert complications that can lead to lasting health issues after birth. Many postpartum conditions cause considerable suffering in women's daily life long after birth, both emotionally and physically, and yet they are largely underappreciated, underrecognized, and underreported, said Dr. Pascale Alote, Director of Sexual and Reproductive Health and Research at WHO. Throughout their lives and beyond motherhood, women need access to a range of services from healthcare providers who listen to their concerns and meet their needs so they not only survive childbirth, but can enjoy good health and quality of life. Despite their prevalence, these conditions have been largely neglected in clinical research, practice, and policy, the paper notes. During a literature review spanning the last 12 years, the authors identified no recent high-quality guidelines to support effective treatment for 40% of the 32 priority conditions analyzed in their study, and found not a single high-quality guideline from a low- or middle-income country. Data gaps are also significant. There were no nationally representative or global studies for any of the conditions identified through the research. Taken as a whole, the special series in The Lancet, titled Maternal Health in the Perinatal Period and Beyond, calls for greater attention to the long-term health of women and girls after and also before pregnancy. According to its opening paper, a holistic approach is needed to reduce maternal deaths, focusing not only on their immediate biomedical causes, but also on the complex interplay of broader social, economic, and environmental conditions that affect women's health. These include factors like racial and gender inequalities, as well as economic context, nutrition, sanitation, environmental risk, or exposure to violence and conflict. Lack of attention to such fundamental issues helps explain why 121 out of 185 countries have failed to significantly progress in reducing maternal deaths over the past two decades, the paper contends. Maternal health is not just something that we should start worrying about when the pregnancy bump appears, says Yao Paulo Souza, Center Director of the Latin American Caribbean Center on Health Sciences Information for the Pan American Health Organization and the World Health Organization, and one of the authors of the first paper. There are many factors that influence the likelihood of a woman will have a healthy pregnancy, from the environment around her to the political and economic system she lives in, or access to nutritious food, and the level of agency she has over her life. All of these need to be addressed to improve her health, alongside access to high-quality health care throughout her life. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to the United States and look at a women's health issue that has grown more problematic. This from the Associated Press. It's taking longer to get an abortion in the U.S. Doctors fear riskier, more complex procedures. A woman whose fetus was unlikely to survive called more than a dozen abortion clinics before finding one that would take her, only to be put on a weeks-long waiting list. A teen waited 7 weeks for an abortion because it took her mother that long to get her an appointment. Others seeking the procedure face waits because they struggled to travel hundreds of miles for care. Such obstacles have grown more common since Roe v. Wade was overturned in June 2022, causing delays that can lead to abortions that are more complex, costly, and in some cases riskier, especially as pregnancies get further along. All of those things can contribute to delays, and then it kind of becomes like this vicious circle, said Dr. Daniel Grossman, an OB-GYN at the University of California, San Francisco, who co-authored a research report earlier this year that compiled anecdotes from healthcare providers after Roe was overturned. People may miss the window for medication abortions, which are not generally offered past 10 or 11 weeks gestation. A dwindling number of clinics provide abortions as people move through the second trimester, which begins at 13 or 14 weeks. Costs for the procedure change too, from up to $800 in the first trimester to $2,000 or more in the second trimester. While abortion is safe at all points in pregnancy, with an overall complication rate of about 2%, it gets more complicated as the pregnancy continues, says Dr. Colleen McNicholas, Chief Medical Officer of Planned Parenthood of the St. Louis region. It does carry additional risks. The necessity for people to travel out of state is at the root of abortion delays. Clinics run by Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains, which operates in Colorado, New Mexico, and southern Nevada, saw out-of-state patients more than double after Roe. And Planned Parenthood of the St. Louis region's health center in Fairview Heights, Illinois, saw a 715% increase in patients from outside of Illinois or Missouri in the year after Roe. We know that abortion bans have caused a ripple effect and increased wait times even in states where access is protected. The ongoing Myers Abortion Appointment Availability Survey called more than 700 facilities across the U.S. Its latest survey, conducted in September, found that 11 states had median appointment wait times of more than 5 business days, and 4 states had waits of at least 8 business days, not counting weekends or holidays. The longest wait was in Iowa at 12 business days. A year earlier, the survey found Iowa had a median wait of 13 business days, and six other states had waits between 12 and 15 business days. Clinics have taken numerous steps to reduce waits, such as adding more telehealth appointments for medication abortions, staying open longer, and adding more staff. That's generally brought appointment wait times down and also helped people obtain other types of reproductive care at the clinics in a timely fashion. For instance, if someone's sexually active and they don't want to become pregnant, we want to get them on birth control, said Adrian Mancinares, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains. If they are experiencing symptoms of a sexually transmitted infection, we want to get them treated. But streamlining appointments is only part of the answer to reducing abortion delays, providers said. Individual issues like childcare problems, canceled flights, and financial concerns can be tough to overcome. Even when clinics try to help by connecting patients to abortion funds, for instance. This is especially difficult as travel distances grow longer. Research by Myers and colleagues found the average driving distance to the nearest clinic rose substantially in some states after Roe. From March 22 to September 2023, it shot up from 34 to 160 miles in Alabama and from 43 miles to 499 miles in Texas. So while providers have made some progress in bouncing back from the initial shock of Roe v. Wade being turned over, there are still many barriers, and traveling by not having health care available in your state is a huge problem.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal healthcare. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if that turns out not to be true, I will grant you triple your money back. Okay, well, next up we have a story which reinforces the sad reality that racism is alive and well in our healthcare system. This from Medical Express. Many people of color worry good healthcare is tied to their appearance. Many people from racial and ethnic minority groups brace themselves for insults and judgments before medical appointments, according to a new survey of patients that reaffirms the prevalence of racial discrimination in the U.S. health system. The Kaiser Family Foundation survey of nearly 6,300 patients who have had care in the past 3 years found that about 55% of black adults feel they have to be very careful about their appearance to be treated fairly by doctors and other health providers. Nearly half of American Indian, Alaskan Native, and Hispanic patients feel similarly, as do about 4 in 10 Asian patients. By comparison, 29% of white people surveyed said they worried about their appearance before appointments. In 2023, the notion that any person must prepare for discrimination is sad on one hand and angering on the other, Burgess Harrison, executive director of the National Minority Health Association, wrote. The stresses that this caused, in addition to whatever health issue involved, is crazy. Discrimination has long been a concern for both patients and health providers in the U.S., where racial disparities in health outcomes are vast and particularly unfavorable towards black people. Other findings? Nearly a quarter of black adults, 19% of Alaskan Native and Native American adults, 15% of Hispanic adults, and 11% of Asian adults said they believe they endured negative treatment because of their race or ethnicity. 22% of black adults who were pregnant or gave birth in the past 10 years said they were denied pain medication they thought they needed. just 10% of white adults in similar circumstances reported the same complaint. When people don't feel respected or welcomed by their healthcare providers, they may be discouraged to reach out for medical help or may switch providers more often. Members of minority populations are found to be experiencing worse health as a result of experiencing unfair treatment in the healthcare system. Black people who self-report darker skin tones were more likely to have encountered discrimination than those with lighter skin, the survey found. Diversity among healthcare providers matters, the survey found. Most people of color who participated in the survey said that fewer than half of their medical visits in the past 3 years were with a provider who shared their race or ethnicity. But black patients who had at least half their visits with a provider of their race or ethnicity, for example, were more likely to report better experiences, such as the doctor explaining things in a way they could understand or asking them about health factors such as their employment, housing, and access to food and transportation. Nearly 40% of black adults whose health providers were also black said they discussed such economic and social subjects, while just 24% of black adults who saw providers who weren't black said those issues were brought up. Harrison of the National Minority Health Association said, "A renewed emphasis on recruiting more people of color into the healthcare field is vital." The survey, he added, painfully illustrates that racial bias in healthcare is as damaging as any disease. Well, my friends, greed, racism, and sexism are unfortunately persistent tragedies in our healthcare system, deforming the level of and quality of health that we could be providing with more justice and equity in our system.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, that brings us to our next segment, Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. Well, we have 32 bonus articles, so let's get to it. Up first, an Ohio story. Legal weed takes effect in Ohio as lawmakers scramble to change voter pass laws. So, unlike a constitutional amendment with the state, what the state legislature can't change on their own, if Ohioans pass a law through a voter initiative, that they're still subject to be changed by Ohio lawmakers. If you're curious about what they're trying to do, take a look at that one. Bonus article two, about a pillar of health, which is sleep. Working night shifts is associated with sleep disorders in more than half of workers. So it's one of those things that, capitalism is more about efficiency and productivity and capital than it is about workers. Perhaps we shouldn't have people working crazy shifts when you're doing things that could be done at other times. If you're working in a factory, working in the middle of night might not make sense. If you have to work in a hospital or another essential service, that's another story. Bonus article three. The World Health Organization calls on countries to increase taxes on alcohol and sugary sweetened beverages. So, this is something with health policy that increasing the cost of things like alcohol and sugary sweetened beverages can actually bring positive health outcomes in the population. But of course, this often conflicts with other tax policy and other things that we want to accomplish through tax policy. For instance, there's some countries that have taxes on sugary sweetened beverages, but they also have taxes on water, which the WHO doesn't recommend. Not a good idea. So there are many opportunities where we can align public health policy and tax policy to achieve various goals that are good for the people. Bonus Article 4, EPA orders packaging firm to stop making PFAS. So this is the forever chemical. This packaging firm produces a lot of plastics, and unfortunately, PFAS, particularly the ones they were producing, migrate easily into consumer goods or food. And it's good to see that the EPA is actually starting to pick around at enforcing this, because these forever chemicals are all over the place and not well regulated. Bonus Article 5. The Air Force is expanding a review of cancers for service members who worked with nuclear missiles. I reported on this before, so this is a good follow-up. And I can tell you, if they're expanding your review, where there's smoke, there's fire, they're finding stuff. So folks that were in these nuclear missile silos were exposed to toxic chemicals, not just radiation, but other toxic chemicals as well. Bonus Article 6, public health groups alarmed at White House delay of menthol cigarette ban. This is another one where, you know, politics gets in the way sometimes of good public health regulation. And of course, politics is an essential part of public health, because it is about the body politic and the health thereof. But in this case, the menthol cigarette ban is something that disproportionately affects the black population, but there's been a concerted effort politically since Democrats are one of the main constituencies is black folks. There's some people making the arguments bolstered by the tobacco companies that somehow banning menthol cigarettes is going to somehow harm black folks. That's a really good deal. Bonus Article 7. Don't neglect tobacco use in people experiencing homelessness. Cessation programs can save lives and improve financial stability. So like reported earlier in the show, that minority folks experience tobacco use costs much more than white folks. So targeting them for prevention to not start smoking in the first place, or cessation, is really important. And in this case, a special population, homeless folks, by having cessation programs, it can save lives and improve their financial stability. Because if you have very little money, a tobacco habit can be pretty expensive. Bonus Article 8, U.S. medical schools aren't teaching future doctors about 7.4 million of their patients with intellectual disabilities. So this is another vulnerable population that's not necessarily being addressed well, and we need to teach our future doctors about how to deal with patients that have intellectual disabilities. Bonus Article 9, Mpox surge in Congo raises concerns world will ignore warnings again. So there's a new, more virulent strain in the Congo and in neighboring African countries where the Mpox is endemic. Usually it's from animals that it pops up in the human population and then sort of peters out because it's not that infectious, but there's a new strain that's more infectious. And the question is, will the world, trying to avoid an Mpox pandemic, try to take care of it, the root problem, before it starts getting transferred all around with something that's more contagious? And in a follow-up story to that, bonus Article 10, stigma, regulatory barriers delay Mpox response in country that needs it most, which of course is Congo in this instance. So this is a good example. You know, the world needs to have a response, but also even within the Congo, there's a lot of stigma and regulatory barriers that they need some help with in order to make prevention work. Bonus Article 11, stalemate on AIDS relief, that's that PEPFAR program, to drag into 2024. So this is an example of where, unfortunately, having a deadlocked, gridlocked Congress, which is by bipartisan efforts ever since the George Bush, Baby Bush era, has had this one of the most successful public health programs globally, is being not continued to be funded, which can endanger the long-term health of the program and those people that depend on it. Bonus Article 12. Indian companies are bringing one of the world's most toxic industries to Africa, and people are getting sick. This is battery recycling industries, and it's caused a lot of problems in India. Of course, one of the reasons they're moving it someplace else with less public health controls, and that would be Africa, and it's causing a lot of problems. Lead poisoning, the worst, but it's very toxic in other ways as well. Bonus Article 13. New England Journal of Medicine reckons with its racist past and complicity in slavery. This is trying to make some amends and some recognition of how racism has played in the academic medical journal, New England Journal of Medicine. So that's good to see, a long time coming, and hopefully that'll make some small amends for the damage that's done over the generations. Bonus Article 14. Changes to race ethnicity data collection will impact health by improving assessment. So I had reported last week that there was changes in the census that was going to affect the amount of people with disabilities collected, which it was going to get cut in half, the amount of data collection we have among folks that are disabled. But this is actually going to be an improvement for collecting data on race and ethnicity, and will help do better assessment and targeting programs and the like. Bonus Article 15. After living with sickle cell disease for 39 years, I'm both excited and skeptical about the newly approved gene therapies. So this is someone who has sickle cell disease and works in the field and is talking about the many challenges about this new expensive gene therapy that I reported earlier in the program. Bonus Article 16. Cost of lead poisoning drug jumps from $3,500 to $32,000, making it hard for hospitals to stock. So this isn't used that often because this is really a serious acute lead poisoning that you have to chelate the lead out of your body. But because it's become so expensive, just price gouging by the producer, hospitals aren't actually stocking it. So when you get a patient that needs this, you may take days or longer to actually get a hold of some, and that can be a critical delay in somebody who's suffering from acute lead poisoning. Bonus Article 17. Gaming the patent system can keep biosimilars off the market for decades. So biosimilars is a category of pharmaceuticals that is actually very profitable. One of these really high-tech pharmaceuticals, but by playing around with the patent system, they delay patents on certain elements of the system so that they can keep, you know, kind of leapfrogging, extending their patents, which keeps it out of the generic market for even decades. Bonus Article 18, White House says it can seize taxpayer-supported drug patents to lower prices. So many drugs are actually developed with research dollars from federal taxpayers. And basically what the White House is saying is that it has march-in rights in these cases and can actually give that patent to other drug producers who can produce it at a lower price. Bonus Article 19. FDA inspections of foreign drug manufacturers haven't bounced back after the pandemic. So we're down about 79% of inspections from foreign drug manufacturers and about 35% for domestic inspection of drug manufacturers. And it doesn't seem to be bouncing back after the pandemic. Bonus Article 20. Millions of people use tainted breathing machines. The FDA failed to use its power to protect them. Another example, you can have regulatory power, but if you don't have the political will or perhaps the staff, then it doesn't work. Bonus Article 21. Investigation reveals how a hospital bowed to political pressure to stop treating trans teens. Another example how political pressure can affect healthcare, and particularly of vulnerable populations that are politicized. Bonus Article 22. Corporate ownership worsens patient care, survey doc says. Reduced autonomy and focus on financial incentives among top negative impacts cited by doctors. So These pressures reduce their autonomy to practice medicine, and the focus on financial incentives perverts the practice they would do without those financial incentives. Bonus Article 23. Biden wants states to ensure Obamacare plan networks cover enough doctors and hospitals. So having skinny networks is something that's really common with Obamacare, with Medicare Advantage plans, all kinds of private healthcare plans. And for Obamacare, Biden wants to bolster that and make sure that you have enough doctors and hospitals and providers in your plan network. Bonus Article 24. The pain and the trauma last longer than a news cycle. White House has a new special office to tackle gun violence. Can it stop the bloodshed? So, years ago, well, and continuing to this day, the gun lobby has huge impact. But whereas the access to the White House was considered an assumption, this is the first time that a White House has actually had a special office to specifically try to tackle gun violence. Whether it can stop the bloodshed is a good question, because obviously we need legislative approaches to really get at that, but it can make a positive difference. Bonus Article 25. They watched their husbands win the Heisman, then lost them to CTE, a deadly reminder of a sport's violent toll. So CTE is that concussion traumatic injury, or chronic traumatic injury to the brain from playing contact sports like football. And it's a real tragedy for those folks who can make a career in these sports, often have to pay a deadly price. Not a good way to live a life suffering from CTE, or to die very much younger because your brain basically falls apart and stops working. Bonus Article 26. Clients bring politics into the therapy room. Here's what that means for the therapist. So this is a really interesting article from a therapist who talks about an encounter with the Israel-Palestine conflict, bringing up issues for both the therapist and the client and trying to work through from them. Very interesting. Bonus Article 27. Navajo Nation faces possible new threats after decades of uranium mining and the largest nuclear disaster in American history. Now, I must admit, I did not know that the Navajo Nation back in 1979 had the largest nuclear disaster in American history. This happened about 3 months after Three Mile Island, and this was having to do with uranium mining processing and uranium being released into the environment, the largest nuclear disaster in the U.S. And of course, now a Canadian company wants to restart uranium mining again, as there's been kind of a rebooting of support for nuclear power. Bonus Article 28. Mexico's activist companion networks quietly provide abortion pills and support to U.S. women. So, as the U.S. has made abortion illegal in many states, Mexico actually decriminalized abortion recently. And because there's a lot of connections between the U.S. and Mexico, these activist networks are helping provide U.S. women with access to abortion pills. Go activists. Bonus Article 29, a seasonal one, debunking the holiday suicide myth. Well, the holiday suicide myth is alive and well, and when suicide is covered as a holiday issue, it's rightly reported about 60% of the time, but 40% of the time it reinforces this myth, the myth being that there's more suicides during holidays. In fact, it's the exact opposite. There's actually the lowest months of suicide are in the winter around the holidays. And this is actually even true if you go to Australia, where the seasons are reversed by month. In the colder months, you actually have less suicide. Very interesting. Unfortunately, by taking something that makes a little bit of sense, you can parlay something into misinformation. And with that, this. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, that's the perfect segue to a COVID-19 story, which, of course, our thinking about COVID-19 has been completely polluted by an environment of conspiracy theories. And bonus article 30, an interesting scientific rundown from a detour to global dominance, the rise of the JN1 variant, which has become dominant in several countries and looks like it will be dominant in the U.S. in the coming weeks, probably right around Christmas and New Year's when people are gathering together. Now, the interesting thing about this, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 virus is a very wily adaptive virus. And usually what we've seen in the past with its evolution, it's happened in a ladder format where it just gets one more thing at one mutation after another in kind of a sequential way, and it slowly changes over time, and you reach a certain point where, boom, it looks like it's actually kind of a completely new variant. Well, this new JN1 really jumped from the ladder that's been what's been evolving the last year or so in many, many variants, back to an earlier variant where there's been quite a big change, but it is switched. So it's sort of like, rather than having a sibling become the new thing, this is kind of like a cousin becoming. And it seems to have a great competitive advantage, meaning that it's more infectious. So it looks like we're still going to have COVID-19 is a substantial issue. Now, even before this, I could have told you that was true, but this amps that up just another couple notches, because COVID-19 is expected to kill more than flu and RSV and pneumonia combined. So it is probably for the foreseeable future going to be the predominant respiratory virus. It doesn't seem to want to settle down. Bonus article 31, screen time tied to mental health problems in kindergarten children. So there's been a lot of cultural changes that kids have had to deal with in the last generation, say 20 years. But screen time is one, a new thing that, of course, the American Academy of Pediatrics really promotes that kids shouldn't even be looking at screens if you're under age 2, and you should have limited use in those early years. But screen time, particularly high amounts of screen time and stuff that isn't child-directed, stuff that's child-directed is a little bit different, but if they're just passively viewing stuff, it pretty much sucks the life out of your brain and leads to developmental problems, which can aggravate and lead to mental health problems. So this is a large cultural issue and a good example of how technology can drive some untoward side effects in public health. And last, but not least, bonus article 32. This is a big picture, fresh perspective, opening a new path on climate and the future. Adapting to climate change does not address the societal systems and values that spawn the current crisis. What's needed is systemic adaptation that fundamentally changes our economy, our politics, and our priorities in a way that puts community and the planet first. Of course, that's a lot of what Just for the Health of It is about, putting the just in Just for the Health of It. We want to live in just communities on a just planet, and that requires a more fundamental rethinking and action to line up our values and our politics and our economy to something that's more sustainable and will keep us on a healthy future, avoiding climate change and all of its untoward effects into the future. A good long read. We need to prepare ourselves for a new future, hopefully a healthy one. You can read this and all the other articles online that I've reported in this episode and earlier episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.